Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad to have you all with us today. Before we introduce the panel for today, I want to first of all tell you we are back on Facebook Live this afternoon, as we will be every time the show is on the air. If you want to watch the show as well as be able to listen to it, just go to the GPB News page on Facebook, and you can watch the show there. And we also have added yet another platform. You can watch it now on the Political Rewind website as well. Just do one or the other. I don't want you to get confused. And that web address is gpb.org/PR for Political Rewind. And I want to tell you, we were extraordinarily gratified. Tom Faust, Olivia Rheingold, Tyler Morris, our team for Political Rewind, with the response we got Monday. There were literally hundreds and hundreds of you who came to the Facebook page to watch the show, and your comments were, some of you, you know, we're used to getting criticized, and that's fine, but so many of you said how happy you were to be able to see us do this show. So thank you for being a part of the show, and I hope you'll continue to check us out, whether it's on the radio, on our Facebook page, or on the website. With all that said, Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the AJC, who's here on Wednesdays, is here with me today. Hey, it's good to see you.
Yeah, this means no more flip-flops and T-shirts for us.
That's exactly right. You have got, but you're always in a suit and tie because that's your beat. You know, almost mandates it.
Yeah, I'd rather be overdressed than underdressed.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
My mantra.
We also welcome for the first time Habersham County Commissioner, Republican Commissioner Natalie Crawford. Natalie, it's great to have you here. You said you've listened to the show. It's really nice to have you with us.
It's great to be here. It's looks like it's going to shape up to be an interesting and exciting show
Yeah, we always have too much to talk about. And joining us again from our Macon Bureau is the head of the Political Science Department at Mercer University, Chris Grant. Chris, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure, and I'm glad I'm invisible.
Well, and yeah, well, thank you for mentioning that. We do not at this point have the technology to bring onto the live video feed people from other offices. Who knows? Maybe we'll work on that, too. So, Chris, you're welcome to wear T-shirts and flip-flops. But thanks for being here.
Thanks very much.
All right. Greg, let's start with a kind of, you know, it's one of the big bombshells of the qualifying period so far. We're now 3 days into qualifying. Every candidate who wants to run for a state office in Georgia has to qualify starting on Monday. Qualifying ends Friday at noon. And there was a big announcement when a Democratic woman walked in and qualified for an office she wasn't expected to. Tell us about it.
Yeah, we're talking about Lucy McBath. She is a nationally known gun control advocate whose son, Jordan, was shot to death in a dispute in 2012, who became known as a prominent gun control force. She showed up with President Barack Obama at some of his events. She's testified.
She was invited to speak, I think, at a White House event under President Obama.
Yeah, she spoke at the Democratic National Convention. Mm-hmm. She has testified before Congress and at four or five state legislatures. She was already looking at, she was already planning to run for a state House seat up in Marietta against a Republican Sam Teasley, who is known for being a very forceful advocate of religious liberty legislation, and also had an A rating with the NRA. And she had already raised more than $100,000 in that race. Well, she switched. She switched just yesterday.
Yeah, we mentioned her on Monday when Melita Easters was here, because she's been promoting Democratic women for offices as somebody who had an awfully good chance to win that Sam Teasley seat. And then yesterday, she changed it up on us.
Yeah, she said she feels like she could be much more of use in Washington rather than Atlanta. She said she was so frustrated watching Donald Trump meet with legislative leaders after the Parkland shooting, the mass shooting in Florida, and seeing a lot of them really not challenge him to the way that she would. And she said, we have to, in her words, she said, we have to outthink Republicans. We have to challenge them in Washington. And she just feels like she could be a more forceful advocate up there.
So, Natalie, we should be quick to point out that there are already a couple of Democrats running for that 6th district seat. That, of course, is the seat that Karen Handel won in a special election in the most expensive congressional election ever.
$60 million.
She beat John Ossoff. So before we can talk about her chances of beating Karen Handel, we have to say she's got some opposition. One of them, Bobby Cagle, who is former news anchor and who's raised a fair amount of money. But how nervous do you think Karen Handel ought to be if a woman with national credentials comes forward, ends up as the nominee of the party?
Well, I think it's definitely going to make for a more interesting race. And, I think McBath made a good statement when she talked about, win or lose, it's going to, raise this conversation, if you will. And I think she's absolutely right in that. But ultimately, if she takes the primary, I don't think she wins the race. I don't think that Handel.
All right.
It's real tough. I mean, think about it. After $60 million was spent, Ossoff raised half of that himself, $30 million for Ossoff alone. He still lost that special election by 4 points. Now, the counter to that is in a general, a midterm election with a lot more voter turnout and a lot more competitive races on the ballot, it could help Democrats, but of course, it could also help Republicans.
Also, Chris, her entry into the race certainly raises the profile of gun, call it what you will, gun safety or gun control. It is going to be, in many ways, you can anticipate it will be, even in the Democratic primary, a referendum on gun control. Yes?
Yes. And remember back to 1996 when Carolyn McCarthy ran in Long Island and beat a Republican incumbent, did very well in a place she wasn't expected to do well because she had a personal story to tell about her husband and her son being shot on the Long Island Express train. I think that Lisa McBath lives in the district. That should help her some. She has a compelling story. That should help her some. It is the district in the state that is probably the most competitive. That doesn't mean the Democrats have the upper hand, but it is a competitive district. She could attract a lot of national attention and raise some money out of it.
Yeah, we should. It's interesting, Chris. I hadn't thought about Carolyn McCarthy, but you're absolutely right. She, remember, there was that awful, awful shooting on the Long Island Railroad. A shooter who literally just walked onto the train and began shooting. There was no motive that we knew. He wasn't targeting anyone specifically. He just wanted to shoot people, right?
Yep. And it's reminiscent of that story. I'm not saying that history is going to repeat itself, but there is a certain reminiscence of that story.
And there's another interesting wrinkle to this as well. Ms. McBath worked for Delta Airlines for 30 years before retiring. And she said that that factored into her decision as well. The fact that the state GOP voted to punish Delta Airlines, as we all know, last week, really helped galvanize her decision to run for office.
Natalie, the person who is happiest, perhaps, about her entry into the congressional race is Republican Sam Teasley.
Yes,
he's in a very, very vulnerable place in that district, and
right.
She could have been a powerful contender.
I think would have been. So he's certainly breathing a sigh of relief. But, I mean, to your point about her having worked for Delta and, of course, all that's going on with that conversation currently, I do think it's going to be a very interesting race, and I think, we're going to see lots and lots of money raised for this as well, and certainly one to watch. As you said, it will definitely be a referendum on gun control.
Chris, you're down there in Middle Georgia. What do you see around you? I mean, we know Macon is a Democratic island in the middle of what has become red territory. Where is the gun safety, gun control debate stand down there?
Well, I think if you look outside of the city center of Macon, you're going to have a lot of folks that are strong advocates of possession and the ability to retain a firearm to protect themselves. I think even inside the city, you'll find folks that want to be able to have guns. But I don't think that's really where the debate is so much. I think people, when I talk and we have conversations about it, are interested in some forms of regulation, maybe licensing people that possess firearms. I mean, there is an interest in doing something about the proliferation of firearms. And that certainly isn't what the NRA would be saying, but not everybody that has a gun is an NRA member.
Yeah, I was at Georgia State University's Newton campus earlier today talking to a lot of students about politics, and I got a lot of questions from conservatives and liberals, millennials, asking about when the debate is going to change. And I told them what's happening at the Georgia State House, that there's very little traction for any sort of gun control measures this year. But I mentioned what I often do, which is There has been a seismic change in the Democratic approach in Georgia to gun control, with both Democratic candidates for governor calling for gun control measures, whereas in past statewide election cycles, you saw Democrats going the other way. You saw Jason Carter voting for the Guns Everywhere bill. You saw Roy Barnes with a high rating from the NRA. So it's you're starting to see that change, at least on the Democratic Party in Georgia, which is a significant one.
Natalie, we're not going to see that change taking place in Habersham, or are we? I mean, you're up there kind of on the edges of rural North Georgia.
Where they love their guns. They're not going to see that change. However, I will say, you know, I mean, we've got Piedmont College right there in the center of the county, and I actually worked there for about 10 years and working with this millennial group of students, you know, I think what they're pushing for is not necessarily no guns, but common sense measures.
What does
with
that
regard
mean?
To, well, it, you know, exactly. That is the question, right? And they don't even articulate that very well. But bans on AR-15, for example, and assault rifles is usually where that conversation goes. So I think in time, as more of these millennials begin to vote, then it does change the tenor of the conversation in terms of what gun control means.
Chris, did you want to jump in?
All I'd say is that sometimes I think about it kind of like what we do with cars and licensing people to drive. If you're going to have a gun, which is designed to be a lethal weapon, I sure do want you to know how to fire it, keep it safe, and keep it out of the hands of my kids.
Absolutely.
And I think that lots of people would say common sense, let's make sure if you're going to have a gun, you know how to use it and you know how to keep it safe. I had a great aunt that used to sleep with a pistol under her pillow, and we were terrified of the call that was going to come out of Sylacauga about that. I mean, so I wish that she would have had some training, and that seems to be a place where we could find some commonality.
Well, I mean, Chris, to your point, you know, what good does it do us to have guns everywhere, as you say, if we don't know how to use them? I mean, it's one thing to have somebody trained, especially in an active shooter situation, and this is often a conversation on campuses. It's one thing to have somebody who's trained to use firearms and has been in a combat situation, if you will.
Yep.
It's not the same as going out on, you know, a Saturday morning to hunt for your trophy deer. So what good does it do us to have guns everywhere if we're not trained in how to use them when the argument is so much protection?
You know, I took us away.
Absolutely.
And I took us away from the 6th District race and wandered into gun control. As long as I'm there and I have you here, Nancy, Natalie, what's the appetite up your way for teachers being armed in the classroom for that kind of school safety?
I would say we're kind of a mixed bag on that. You know, there's certainly teachers and those who are married to teachers who would make the argument for allowing them to carry, and that would be both in your, you know, secondary and post-secondary levels that argument's being made. But it's also a mixed bag. I have a lot of teacher friends who say, I don't want guns in the classroom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not even if I'm the one carrying it.
All right, let me get back and put a period on the starting conversation, Greg, the 6th District. To finish it up, as I said, we're going to have 3 Democrats in this race.
At least.
Right. We don't know by the end, but we'll find out more by Friday at noon. Is she, given that she has $100,000 in the bank already, has shown, demonstrated, she knows how to raise money, given her high profile, does she become the de facto front runner in this race?
I'd say yes. And remember, she can't necessarily
for
transfer.
For the Democratic nomination.
Yeah, for the Democrat. She can't necessarily transfer that $100,000 because it was raised for a state race and she has to offer refunds first. But yes, she already has demonstrated she can raise a tremendous amount of money for a very down-ticket race. This will be getting some national attention because it's still the most expensive House election. Karen Handel is still probably the most prominent freshman Republican in Congress, at least in the U.S. House. So, I think, you know, compared to her other opponents, a former newscaster on a CBS affiliate and Kevin Abel, who's a businessman, she has a higher profile. Now, I will say that Bobby Capel, the aforementioned newscaster, has lined up a lot of endorsements in Washington and here in Atlanta, including Andrew Young just the other day. So he's already worked to consolidate the Democratic base after John Ossoff said he was not going to make a second bid.
All right. Well, it is certainly going to make, as we've all said, that an interesting primary to watch. And again, we could be going into the fall seeing that race develop into a real referendum on how people in the 6th District feel about gun control measures. Let's move on and get in one more subject before we have to take a break, Greg. Your colleague, Jim Galloway, wrote a column in the AJC, and I didn't introduce you. Did I already say you're the political? Yeah, I said you were a political reporter.
Probably.
Yeah, I did. He wrote a piece about this interesting meeting at the Capitol the other day, the state Capitol, among Cobb County legislators, some business leaders, some transportation officials, and others trying to figure out what Cobb ought to do about joining this regional compact, which is developing. So I'd really love you to help us understand it, because I'm not sure I understand what's happening, and I'm not sure if our listeners do. So the starting point of this is there is a measure that is being debated that would allow Metro Atlanta counties, what, 13 of them, 12 of them, to impose a new sales tax specifically earmarked for transit. Do I have that part of it right?
It would allow them to, to vote on it. Yeah.
Right.
It's sort of an umbrella group that they're calling right now the ATL. It would have state oversight over MARTA. The long argument was MARTA wanted more state investment and state funding, but in order to do that, the state wanted a seat at the table. And this could be the sort of pave the path for a mass transit expansion across Metro Atlanta beyond Fulton and DeKalb County and Clayton County, where it's already operating.
And there are 12 or 13 counties that have expressed interest in buying into. They would end up having referenda on whether they should add a one penny sales tax earmarked specifically for transit.
Yeah, and of course, the booster's argument is saying, look at where the business is going. Look at State Farm that just built a regional headquarters on the Dunwoody-MARTA line. Look at NCR, which just moved to Gwinnett, which does not have mass transit into, or at least rail mass transit, into Midtown Atlanta right on another MARTA line. And then the counter to that, especially in Cobb County, is there's a willingness to take a step toward that argument, but there's a worry about the cost and the benefit to Cobb County in the long run.
So Cobb County has been excluded for the time being from this measure. Natalie, what's interesting to me about this is it seems to be, and Greg will correct me if I'm wrong, to a large extent a divide between South Cobb County, say Smyrna, the Cumberland Mall area, the Braves Stadium area,
right.
And those folks who live up, in rural, in real suburban Cobb County.
Right. And that's where you're hearing that conversation about shouldn't we be able to control our own destiny? And, if we're at, what is it, one-tenth of a penny now?
Right now.
One penny seems to be far and beyond what we need to be taxing our citizens. So it really is a divide in conversation, especially, and you see that, Tennessee, in a more rural area where they say, No more taxes in whatever kind they are. We want to control our own destiny and sort of drive that conversation.
So when the House voted on this bill, they were able to pull Cobb out, Chris Grant, to let Cobb make its own decisions to not pollute the vote with Cobb County legislators maybe voting against it just because they don't want they're worried about the voters up in the north part of the county. And so Cobb still has to figure out what to do, and they've only got a few weeks to do it.
It's a mystery to those of us in Middle Georgia. We're still waiting for that train that's been promised for a quarter of a century to get here. I think that one of the things that's interesting to me is if you look at Washington, D.C., we've seen all these mini city centers bump up around the metro stations. And last few times I've been in Atlanta, I've been watching and seeing that happen again in Atlanta. I think that there is a demand for rail transportation particularly, but for other forms of transportation, and that the market will take care of it on their own. If Cobb County wants to be in the middle of the development, they'll vote to be in the rail program, and if they don't, they won't.
So, Greg, is Cobb on its last? Are they going to lose out completely if they don't make a decision to jump in before the session ends?
They might, and there might be some sort of. And there, by the way, there's a Senate bill too that has passed the Senate. So there's two dueling versions. But there might be an agreement for them to be part of the framework and just join in. But I asked Governor Deal about that this week, and if he had any sort of early positions on this, and he said he expressed that he really wants to get this done for the next governor, whoever he or she may be, so that framework framework is in place. It might not be the perfect compromise, but he just wants to get this sort of settlement done so that mass transit can have a pathway to expand in Cobb County and Gwinnett County.
All right. We will watch that unfold. Let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way. When we come back, we're going to take a look at a bill that's caused an awful lot of, gotten a lot of attention, a lot of interest, but it appears to be in significant jeopardy right now, and that's the bill that would ban your use of a handheld cell phone while driving. Let's do that after the break. This is Political Rewind.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows, you're all sealed inside, take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported the station, and well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Natalie Crawford from the Habersham County Commission. Chris Grant, political science professor and head of the department at Mercer University down in our Macon Bureau, and Greg Bluestein right here in Atlanta. Greg, you just pointed out, we knew that the governor had called a 2 o'clock news conference to talk about an economic development development. What did he decide? What did he announce?
It is a $750 million Stanton Springs data center out in sort of East Georgia for Facebook. That would be a data center for the tech giant. And officials moved this up. This has been widely reported just a few months ago that this was coming. And there's actually reports saying it could end up growing to be more than $1 billion. But the announcement wasn't set to be until later this month. It got moved up suddenly to today, I think in light of the whole Delta fracas and the worries that it could be spurning companies like Amazon away from Georgia.
So, Chris, these are not high-tech positions. These are not the positions for the highest educated, the best educated IT people, developers and the like, which Amazon would certainly be dealing with. You can understand why the governor would want to move this announcement up, but we really should be cautious about reading too much into it as a harbinger of Amazon moving our direction, shouldn't we?
Sure. And one of the things I wonder about with the governor, particularly in talking about transportation and other things and thinking about some of his legacy is really in continuous with his predecessors, both Democratic and Republican. They have been kind of progressive conservatives where the economic engine of Georgia has been, and we benefit from that greatly down here in Macon. Macon is a more prosperous city because we're in the same state with Atlanta, and we want to see development and jobs coming in. And I think that for a long time, anything that would have derailed the Amazon potential would have been foreboding in the state. And what shocks me is that at this point, we seem to be moving in directions that would go away from that sort of protect the economic engine at all cost. And I mentioned the adoption bill, too, with the entertainment mm-hmm. industry.
Okay. Yeah, we're still waiting. We don't know what the fate of that bill is going to be. Not the adoption bill. That went through fine because it's clean.
Right.
But the William Ligon bill that would allow give cover to religious organizations
That bill passed the Senate.
Yes.
It's still pending in the House. There was talk that it could actually be voted on the House and left to the governor to decide. It looks like the House is going to hold on that this year, but nothing's final until it's final.
Okay. Greg, John Carson, a Republican from Marietta, introduced House Bill 673 at the beginning of the session. He wants to ban the use of cell phones, handheld cell phones, while people are driving. And there were folks who thought for a while that bill might gain some real momentum and get somewhere. But at a forum just mm-hmm. the other night, you report that Casey Cagle, candidate for governor, put the kibosh, as we would say, on that.
Pump the brakes on the hands-free driving bill. Yeah, you know, the speaker on air just last week?
Yes, it was.
Last week was kind of tepid about it, and so I was shocked that it ended up passing the House by a pretty hefty margin. I think it was 130-ish votes. So it ended up easily clearing the House, but in the Senate, it's going to get a lot tougher road.
Is that because there are so many candidates for statewide office
that's
in
part
the Senate?
Of it. And one of them is Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle, who said in a forum last night that this is an uphill battle. Him and the other four leading candidates for Republican candidates for governor all said that this in some way or another, this is a little bit too much government intrusion, that they're worried about a nanny state. They're worried that allowing police to more leeway to pull over people for using handheld devices and talking on the phone in the cars would be too much of a government
intrusion.
Michael
Williams certainly made that point, candidate for governor. But Natalie, I thought Brian Kemp made an interesting comment in this forum about that. Also running, of course, he's our Secretary of State now. He said he sees this as being sort of similar to the old seatbelt, mandatory seatbelt issue. And in fact, we talked about that on the show last week when Speaker Ralston was here, because all of us who have been around, and you grew up in North Georgia, remember when Thomas B. Murphy, the legendary Speaker of the House, was one of the final holdouts on mandatory seatbelts for quite similar. He had a personal story about his daughter, but he also held out for the same kind of thing. You know, our government should not dictate how we live our lives.
True, he did, and you know, I guess I'm sympathetic to that to a large degree. I would say, though, wearing your seatbelt is quite a bit different than texting on your cell phone while you're driving. I mean, you know, if you want to leave your life to chance, greater chance, by not wearing your seatbelt, well, that's a very personal decision. But getting behind the wheel and texting while driving doesn't just put your life at risk. It puts others' lives at risk. However, I'm not in favor of a nanny state. I think that, you know, we could implement some really hefty fines to dissuade folks from picking up that cell phone and you know, achieve what we need to achieve and encourage what we want to encourage with folks not using their phones while driving.
Well, gee,
going too far.
Gee, Chris, here's another moment in which one body of the legislature enthusiastically passes a bill out and the other body sits on it.
Yes.
Where and, have we heard that before?
Yes. It's we're in Georgia, and yeah, this is the way we do things. But I agree with Commissioner. I think that it makes – this is a question of whether we're protecting other people and not – about our own personal freedom. And when it comes down to it, I mean, I've been guilty of being on my phone in the car. Probably not the best idea.
All right. So we'll watch. Greg, what do you think? The Senate now will sit on it if the lieutenant governor doesn't like it, if others in the Senate who are running for office don't like it. It's dead, isn't it?
Yeah, unless there's substantive changes. And I wouldn't rule that out either. There's conference committees. There's amendments. There's all sorts of ways that this could still pass in some form. And by the way, there's already a ban on texting and driving. It's just law enforcement officials say it's too hard to enforce because if you're pulled over for that occasion, you can just say, well, I was using my GPS, or I was dialing a phone number, or I was doing something else that's permitted under the law.
All right, let's move on to another issue. Throughout this week, the ACLU, which is kind of newly energized, I think it's fair to say, Andrea Young, Ambassador Andrew Young's daughter, is now the director of the Georgia chapter, and it's pretty clear that they've made a strong move to insert themselves much more aggressively and in a proactive way in major policies here in the state of Georgia. And they this week have been particularly upset about a training program that's set for tomorrow in Barrow County. The Barrow County Sheriff's Office has decided they're going to do a training session on Islam in America. That sounds on the surface of it as though it might be a wonderful opportunity for education, but the speaker who they've brought in, ACLU says, is someone who over the years has been a real hater, has shown on any number of occasions that he is a no friend. His name is David Boris. He's a former police chief in Woodstock. He's a retired U.S. Army officer. And over the years, he has made comments that have disturbed ACLU and certainly the Islamic community. And they're going to have this conference, Greg, but now Frank Rotundo, who's the head of the Georgia Police Chiefs Association, whose organization helps certify what courses will get credit and not for law enforcement, has pulled his organization out. This is really an interesting question again about how we're dealing with Muslims, with the Islamic community here in the state of Georgia.
Yeah, and the organizer, David Boris, he also, I mean, he's done this presentation, as you mentioned before. He's done it for political groups. He's done it for the Pickens County Tea Party. He's done it for a group in Union County called the Taxed Enough Group. And he's done it for the Greater Republican Women's Club of Fayette County. And after being brought these concerns to his attention, Rotunda, as you mentioned, pulled the approval. And the ACLU is now saying that this is an inflammatory, hateful, and potentially unconstitutional training system.
They point out that in 2016, Boris did a lecture for the Atlanta Vietnam Veterans Business Association in which he said that Muslims are required by their faith to destroy Western civilization, and they do this by slowly conditioning the West to accept Islam by allowing public space to become Muslim space. And there have been any number of inflammatory comments. He's big on condemning Sharia law, which, what is Sharia law exactly? I'm not sure anybody really knows, but David Boris does. So, Natalie, how do we deal with something like this? I mean, how do we bring the Muslims of Georgia into our community in a welcoming way and not have to deal with this sort of thing?
And that's exactly the point, right? I mean, just by nature of having a training course for public safety officers entitled Islam in America clearly links Islam and public safety, and in my mind, not in a good way. And I'm certain in many others. So anytime that you're dealing with any religion and talking about it and how it affects our culture, I think you have to put it all in context. Certainly, we know that there are members of the Islamic faith who have committed terrible atrocities. But when you look through the history of the world, that's happened in all faiths.
Yeah.
So I think you have to put these conversations in context. So I am all for training of our public safety officers, but when it is aimed at the public safety of all. And I think we're singling out a faction of our population here, saying, hey, you're more dangerous than the rest of these folks. And I think that's a dangerous place to
Chris?
Be.
Well, I'm an interesting person to ask that question to. The person who hired me for my job at Mercer is Muslim. I had a roommate in graduate school at the University of Georgia who is Muslim. I feel very comfortable with Muslims. I visit Muslims in the other Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, every other year. I have to say that we do more to do damage to the relationship between practitioners of Islam and the rest of us by specializing and suggesting that they are different or other than the rest of us. And I think that the commissioner had it hit the nail on the head.
And one update, apparently several Muslims tried to sign up for that class and were rejected.
Yeah, that's right. The ACLU just put out a release a few minutes ago saying exactly that. So this training is scheduled for tomorrow, and apparently the Barrow County Sheriff's Department is moving forward with it. So we'll watch and see how that goes. All right. Let's talk about the GOP and both Democratic and the Republican governor's races, Greg. On the Democratic side, it's now pretty official. We could see another candidate, of course, emerge by noon on Friday on the Democratic side, but you're not expecting it. Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans, actually, were both down at the Capitol at almost the same time to qualify yesterday, right?
Yeah, and very different ceremonies. Stacey Evans, a former state lawmaker, qualified in a very quiet ceremony. There was just her immediate family, her husband, her young daughter, I think she's six, her grandmother, her stepfather, and her father were all there, along with two or three aides. And it was very emotional. There was a lot of tears shed. Her mother, who is a Trump supporter from North Georgia, who had to move 16 times in the span of a few years to try to give her daughter a better life, basically said, "I accomplished my mission." She said, "Thanks to the Hope Scholarship and Zell Miller, we did it." So they shared a very tearful embrace. Stacey Abrams, the former state House minority leader, also had her parents there. They surprised her. They drove her from Hattiesburg, Mississippi. for a very different sort of celebration. The moment Stacey Abrams walked in, there was dozens, maybe more than 100 supporters, all dressed in blue, who cheered her. They started chanting, "Stacey, Stacey." It was very, it was very excited atmosphere. There was a bank of cameras watching her. There was another tearful prayer with her and her family, and her mother said, "Thank God we've got to this moment," as they both kicked off their campaigns for governor.
It's you in the Jolt, part of the Political Insider blog, which is part of Politically Georgia at myagency.com.
Which you should subscribe to.
You point out that there's a Washington Post piece that came out yesterday, which is looking at how African Americans nationally are trying to stake out influence in the party that is in some ways commensurate with the numbers that turn out in the African-American community to vote for Democrats. And the Abrams and Stacey Evans race is right in the middle of that article. Stacey Abrams is actually quoted. She went up to Washington to do a National Press Club event on Valentine's Day, and the reporter in the story quotes her as saying that she's seeing indications the party is paying better attention to mobilizing black voters. But she said this, quote, "I've seen initial signs, but what I want to see is a plan for consistent and sustained and deep investment that's not just about special elections, but about systematic change and how we value and invest in black voters." So, you know, Natalie, Stacey Abrams is getting an enormous amount of national attention because she would become the first African-American female governor in the South.
Certainly. And, you know, having...
In the nation.
In the country.
Yes.
Thank you.
Ever.
Ever.
Right.
Right. Thank you.
You know, and she has certainly taken advantage of opportunities to raise her profile, with speaking at the Democratic National Convention. Some of the very pointed positions that she has taken on hot topic issues throughout the country. Civil War monuments, for example, those sorts of things. So she has worked really hard and done a fantastic job on increasing her profile and name recognition. Definitely a force to be reckoned with.
So, Chris and Greg, let me make an observation and see if you think I'm on point or not. Natalie just pointed it out. Abrams has done a great job raising her profile, not just in Georgia, but nationally. And she is making a strong case, and the Washington Post article points it out, for energizing the African-American vote, and she hopes winning the nomination largely on the strength of an energized African-American community. And she's gaining endorsements. Evans is getting endorsements, too. Just the other day, Max Cleland, former U.S. Senator Max Cleland, endorsed her. But Chris, let me start with you and then Greg. I'm wondering if we're seeing enough from her campaign and supporters and endorsers out there to make the case that she can somehow revive the old Yellow Dog Democrat coalition that elected Democrats for more than a century in this state. I'm having a hard time seeing that coming together, and it may be I'm just not observing it properly.
Well, I don't really see it here either, though I have a lot of friends who are very supportive of Stacey Evans, and I think she's a tremendous candidate. I think the reality for the Democrats this time around is they have two incredibly interesting candidates with very compelling stories. I just think it's very hard when you have the chance of nominating the first African-American woman to head the Democratic Party with a non-white majority in the Democratic primary electorate, more than likely, to see Stacey Evans being able to pull the weight that she would need to do to be able to win that race. And the second thing I sort of have added would be that the Democrats really are the minority party, and a divisive primary in the minority party is oftentimes more catastrophic than a divisive primary in the majority party. So in some ways, the Democrats are better off if Stacey Evans doesn't catch fire and mount a really significant challenge. On the other hand, my friends who support her would be disappointed at me for saying that.
Greg, does Stacey Evans need something big, or is that just my shallow way of observing it, that she's quietly making progress? Help me understand this better.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of exactly the tension here, is that this is a divisive primary. They have very different views on some of the hot button issues, including education and guns. Education's a big one. Stacey Evans voted for the Opportunity School District Governor Deal's school takeover bid, and Stacey Abrams didn't. And that's why you're seeing some education groups fall on either side of the candidate. But this is also a race of very different competing strategies. And Stacey Abrams and Evans both talk about it openly. There was just a forum the other day where Stacey Evans said, we cannot rebuild the Democratic coalition without getting back these moderate suburban voters that used to be firm Democrats. And Stacey Abrams said, essentially, that's the definition of insanity. That's trying to do the same thing over and over again and failing. The Democrats have tried that over year after year, yep. election after election, and it hadn't worked. And this is where, you know, it boils down to this. And you're hearing, you know, what Stacey Abrams was saying in that quote you read, she's spent about 80% of the money she's already raised. And what she says she's spending on as an organization is that grassroots level organization. They're not spending on TV yet. They're not spending on ads yet. They're spending on that. But we haven't. We won't find out if that's working until May.
Yeah, it's a remarkable race to watch unfold, Natalie.
It is, and you know, as Greg was just saying, I think that, you know, to go back to that grassroots statement, what you haven't seen a lot of focus on, and I was going to say recent years, but a lot of years from the Democratic Party, is a focus on the rural communities. And I think that the Democrats, to gain any traction in this state and really see some races swing, they're going to have to focus in the rural areas and re-energize that group.
All right. Well, I wanted to get that in. Because lately we've talked an awful lot about the Republican candidates, particularly around Delta. By mm-hmm. the way, before we take our break, Greg, speaking of Delta and Casey Cagle, who made the biggest splash with his anger at Delta for dropping its arrangement with the NRA for ticket discounts mm-hmm. to their convention. He's got a pack out there, which apparently commissioned a poll.
Mm-hmm.
So take it for what it's worth. It's an internet poll, I believe.
That was a phone poll.
Oh, it was a phone poll. All right. They came back and said, well, this is good news. 57% of the people that we polled said that what Cagle did about Delta was correct.
And his numbers overall ticked up from about a month ago, about 6 points. He also qualified yesterday. And was asked about his stance again and kind of repeated what he's been saying all over national news and Fox News, saying that conservatives have to stand for their values. And that's what he did.
All right. We got to get a break in. This is Political Rewind, both on the radio and on Facebook Live at GPB News' Facebook page. We're going to take a break and come back in a moment.
On the next Fresh Air, a return visit from John Oliver, the host of the HBO satirical series Last Week Tonight, on which he reviews the news of the week, then takes a deep dive into one story, which is always both really funny and informative. His approach has been described as investigative comedy. He first became known as a correspondent on The Daily Show. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. I'm here with Greg Bluestein, with Chris Grant, who's down in our Macon Bureau, and Natalie Crawford, who's joining us from way up in Habersham County. You know what, Greg? We're going to talk about Trump and tariffs, especially Senator David Perdue has finally weighed in on all of this. But before we do, a real quick note. The Speaker of the House is in town tomorrow. Paul Ryan is coming to Georgia. And he's going to go to Home Depot. I thought that was an interesting choice. He's going to talk about the tax cuts that they put into law. And it's interesting he's coming. Even as he's at odds with Trump over tariffs, he's coming here to tout what the tax bill is going to do for Americans. But the choice of Home Depot is an interesting one, given that co-founder Bernie Marcus has been one of Trump's most enthusiastic mm-hmm. supporters from the get-go and continues to be so.
Yeah, and the other co-founder, by the way, Arthur Blank, has not.
Not so much.
he's donated to both parties, but he's mostly a Democrat.
Yeah.
And you're going to hear a lot of this over the next few months as Republicans hit the campaign trail more assertively, talking about what they think is the signature domestic achievement of Donald Trump, which is these $1.5 trillion package of tax cuts. And this is sort of the start of it in Georgia. Most of the congressional delegation will be there. I've got texts from a few of the Congress members saying, I'll see you there tomorrow. So you're going to see them hitting the trail. But against that is the tension of just regular folks who might not be seeing as much of that impact in their wallets. You know, some folks are getting a little bit more money back, but not a tremendous amount, not a noticeable amount. It's the Democratic argument is that it's mostly going to the upper levels of the economy and not the regular voters.
Natalie, there's also been certainly the White House was able to crow a little bit when a number of companies, after the bill passed and was signed into law, companies that did give bonuses to their employees, and that was great. I mean, they had good reason to take credit for that. But what's happening is what many critics had suggested all along, and we're seeing more and more, is that companies are taking that money back, reinvesting in some ways, giving that money to their directors. It's kind of been a mixed bag in terms of the kind of benefits that Trump likes to talk about.
Right. And I will tell you, my jury's still sort of out on how I really feel about the new tax bill. To have such an overly complicated problem, I feel like we moved through it very quickly. We may have an oversimplified solution as they're touting it. You know, I'm all for corporations being able to keep as much of their money as they can. Same for individuals. And so, the caution is that it has to be a balanced plan. And I think it's going to take us some time to see if it actually is. Right. You know, one of the conversations we had in terms of local government, you know, was in seeing, the RC grants that were possibly going
those?
To be.
Because,
so when you have regional commission grants.
Regional commission. I just want to make sure I understand that, RC.
Right. Oftentimes federally funded grants for community development, block grants. And so those wound up on the chopping block to pay for, some of these other provisions we're seeing in the new tax bill. And, jury's out. I think we're going to have to take some time to see.
All right. Well, Bluestein, you'll be there. You'll be reporting on this.
I will. And maybe with my 7-year-old in tow if the DeKalb County Schools cancels again tomorrow.
All right. For you people up in out in DeKalb County, of which Greg Bluestein and I are both part of that family, that water main break is making our lives a little bit difficult today.
I will say with regard to Paul Ryan, and I think any time that our federal lawmakers can come to Georgia to see how we do it is great.
All right, yeah, good.
Absolutely.
Let's move on. We've talked on this show ever since President Trump made his surprise announcement about instituting tariffs for steel and aluminum. We've been looking at how Georgia legislators, Georgia members of Congress might respond. Johnny Isaacson was quick to say he thought it was a bad idea, issue a public statement. We've been waiting to hear from David Perdue, and Perdue has now weighed in. He says he thinks that the president has the right idea, in his instincts have been right, but he is hoping that the president will take a more targeted approach. Chris, the White House, the Wall Street Journal reported just about a half hour before we came on the air that they are being pushed hard to get this announcement about the details of the tariff ready for Trump to announce it tomorrow. And that's what they'd said over the weekend, that he was going to try to do it by Sunday. Now, Perdue is saying it ought to be targeted, that we have got to be careful about how we push this thing forward. But the more that President Trump, Chris, gets pushed, the more he pushes back. He's now saying he really thinks it's awful how the Republicans on the Hill are so timid. He seems ready to go full bore on this.
Yes, and I think that Georgia is a state that benefits greatly from trade. All of us benefit from trade. And Senator Isaacson was on the right side of the debate, and Senator Perdue was late to the fray and should have gone over to the White House and said to the president, that's not a good idea. And that's my thought.
Yeah, and Senator Isaacson's opposition is good to note, but Senator Perdue is sort of one of the Trump whisperers. He's one of the president's most loyal allies, especially in the U.S. Senate. And so the fact that he had a quiet meeting with the president, basically trying to lay fear, transmit fears that this could lead to a trade war. What he said he told the White House was to let the economy breathe a little while, to let the effects of the tax overhaul take hold first before taking this step.
All right, but it looks as if we're going to see the tariffs put in place tomorrow. It will be fascinating to see whether the president decides to hunker down and kind of say, I'm doing it my way, or whether he does listen to voices like Purdue's.
I think we've seen him hunker down a lot. So I doubt that would surprise anybody, on the show today. But, my thought initially was, okay, this actually could be an interesting and good negotiation tactic for working with Canada and Mexico. And we have experienced some trade deficits. But, again, it's the thing that worries me, and I think the reason that you hear Senator Perdue having this quiet meeting and sharing some thoughts and requests to show caution is that to move so hastily, have we had time to think through unintended consequences, and do we really want to land in the middle of a trade war? And those are real risks. So I think certainly sound advice to kind of pump the brakes
a
little. But.
Well, we'll see if tomorrow is a day. We got just a couple minutes. So let's take two items at once. Two women who apparently, I want to say be careful here, who allegedly have been in Trump's life, are both in the spotlight. We know one of them definitely has been in Trump's life, Kellyanne Conway. She has now been nabbed as having violated the Hatch Act, Greg, in TV appearances in which she endorsed a candidate for Alabama Senate. It's now up to the White House to decide whether to punish her, and there's no reason to think they're going to.
No, she's a very, again, close ally with Donald Trump. She was his, I think it was campaign manager was her official title for a while there, and also pollster for him even before that. So it doesn't look likely that there will be any official sanctions from the White House against her.
Yeah, it looks like another example of the White House believing that they can just shrug these things off, and guess what? They get away with it.
They get away with it. Yeah, again, so no surprise here. Right. They'll tap dance around the language she used and say that there was no technical, endorsement, so therefore no violation.
All right, I said the reason I used the word allegedly about the two women is the other Stormy Daniels, the porn star who's become probably more famous than we really want her to be. She's now going to file suit against the president because she says that he never signed the agreement that would have required her to maintain her confidentiality about this agreement. And she looks ready, Chris, to just bring a world of hurt on the president if she can, doesn't she?
Yes, and I'm so sorry I got that question because it's just vile. And especially when you remember back to the debates and now President Trump bringing in the Bill Clinton accusers, it seems like it's deja vu all over again.
Well,
here's
what's interesting to me because we're out of time. I remember when the Monica Lewinsky story broke, I was raced to Washington by WSB TV, Cox Television, to cover that story. Get up there as fast as you can. This is the biggest thing to happen in politics. And boy, have times changed. So it's interesting. All right. We are completely out of time for today's show. Chris, Natalie, Greg, thank you so much for being here. We're back again on Friday with another Political Rewind at 2 o'clock. Tomorrow on Two-Way Street, a really interesting show. We're going to talk about the brilliant cartoonist, George Harriman, who wrote a cartoon called Crazy Cat. If you don't know anything about Crazy Cat, you really want to listen to this edition of Two-Way Street at 2 o'clock. I'm Bill Nygut. Have a good evening. We'll see you again soon.